Chapter 6. The Electrical Treatment. A Nighttime Excursion. One Pissed-Off Oki. A Ticket on the Mountain Express. Jacob's electrical workshop was in West Tulsa. I don't know what that part of town is like now, but in 1992, it was a forlorn industrial zone where a lot of the industries seemed to be dead or dying. He pulled into the parking lot of an all-but-destitute strip mall on Olympia Avenue, and parked in front of Wilson Auto Body. It was standing empty for a long time. That's what the realtor told me, Jacob said. He was dressed in faded jeans and a blue golf shirt, his hair washed and combed, his eyes sparkling with excitement. Just looking at him made me nervous. I had to take a year's lease, but it was still dirt cheap. Come on in.
You ought to take down the sign and put up your own, I said. I framed it with hands that were only shaking a little. Portraits and Lightning. C.D. Jacobs, proprietor. It would look good.
I won't be in Tulsa that long, he said, and the portraits are really just a way of supporting myself while I conduct my experiments. I've come a long way since my pastoral days, but I've still got a long way to go. You have no idea. Come in, Jamie. Come in.
He unlocked a door and led me through an office that was empty of furniture, although I could still see square, clean patches on the grimy linoleum where the legs of a desk had once stood. On the wall was a curling calendar with April 1989 showing. The garage had a corrugated metal roof, and I expected it to be baking under the September sun, but it was wonderfully cool. I could hear the whisper of air conditioners. When he flicked a bank of switches, recently modified, judging from the makeshift way the wires stuck out of the uncovered holes where the plates had been, a dozen brilliant lights came on. If not for the oil-darkened concrete and the rectangular caverns where the two lifts had once been, you would have thought it was an operating theater.
It must have cost a fortune to air-condition this place, I said, especially when you got all those lights blazing.
Dirt cheap. The air conditioners are my own design. They draw very little power, and most of that I generate myself. I could generate all of it, but I wouldn't want Tulsa Power and Light down here, snooping around to find out if I was volt-jacking somehow. As for the lights, you could wrap a hand around one of the bulbs without burning yourself, or even heating your skin, for that matter. Our footfalls echoed in all that empty space. So did our voices. It was like being in the company of phantoms. It just feels that way because I'm strung out, I told myself.
Listen, Charlie, you're not messing with anything radioactive, are you?
He grimaced and shook his head. Nuclear is the last thing I'm interested in. It's energy for idiots, a dead end.
So how do you generate the juice?
Electricity breeds electricity. If you know what you're doing. Leave it at that. Step over here, Jamie. There were three or four long tables at the end of the room with electrical stuff on them. I recognized an oscilloscope, a spectrometer, and a couple of things that resembled Marshall amps, but could have been batteries of some kind. There was a control board that looked mostly torn apart, and several stacked consoles with darkened dials. Thick electrical cords snaked every which way. Some disappeared into closed metal containers that could have been craftsman tool chests. Others just looped back to the dark equipment.
This could all be a fantasy, I thought.
Equipment that only comes alive in his imagination. But the portraits and lightning weren't make-believe. I had no idea how he was making those. His explanation had been vague at best, but he was making them. And although I was standing directly beneath one of those brilliant lights, it really did not seem to be throwing any heat.
There doesn't seem to be much here, I said doubtfully. I expected more.
Flashing lights, chrome-plated knife switches sticking out of science fiction control panels, Star Trek telescreens, possibly a teleportation chamber or a hologram of Noah's Ark in a cloud chamber. He laughed cheerily.
Oh, nothing like that, I said, although he had pretty much hit the nail on the head. It just seems kind of sparse.
It is. I've gone about as far as I can for the time being. I've sold some of my equipment. Other stuff, more controversial stuff, I've dismantled and put in storage. I've done good work in Tulsa, especially considering how little spare time I have. Keeping body and soul together is an annoying business, as I suppose you know.
I certainly did.
But yes, I made some progress toward my ultimate goal. Now I need to think, and I don't believe I can do that when I'm turning half a dozen tips a night.
Your ultimate goal being what?
He ignored the question this time, too. Step over here, Jamie. Would you like a small pick-me-up before we begin? I wasn't sure I wanted to begin, but I wanted a pick-me-up all right. Not for the first time, I considered just snatching the little brown bottle and running. Only he'd probably catch me and wrest it away. I was younger and almost over the flu, but he was still in better shape. He hadn't suffered a shattered hip and leg in a motorcycle accident, for one thing. He grabbed a paint-spattered wooden chair and set it in front of one of the black boxes that looked like a Marshall amp. Sit here. But I didn't. Not right away. There was a picture on one of the tables, the kind with a little wedge on the back to prop it up. He saw me reach for it and made a move as if to stop me. Then he just stood there. A song on the radio can bring back the past with fierce, if mercifully transitory, immediacy. A first kiss, a good time with your buddies, or an unhappy life passage. I can never hear Fleetwood Mac's Go Your Own Way without thinking of my mother's last painful weeks. That spring, it seemed to be on the radio every time I turned it on. A picture can have the same effect. I looked at this one, and all at once, I was 8 again. My sister was helping Maury set up dominoes in Toy Corner while Patsy Jacobs played Bringing in the Sheaves, swaying on the piano bench, her smooth blonde hair shifting from side to side. It was a studio portrait. Patsy was wearing the sort of billowy, shin-length dress that went out of fashion years ago, but it looked good on her. The kid was on her lap, wearing short pants and a sweater vest. A cowlick, I remembered well, stuck up on the back of his head. "We used to call him Tagalong Maury," I said, running my fingers lightly over the glass. "Did you?" I didn't look up. His unsteady voice made me afraid of what I might see in his eyes. "Yeah, and all of us boys were in love with your wife. Claire was, too. I think Mrs. Jacobs was what she wanted to be." At the thought of my sister, my own eyes began to fill up. I could tell you it was just because I was physically low and full of craving. And it would be the truth, but not the whole truth. I swiped an arm across my face and set the picture down. When I looked up, he was fiddling with a voltage regulator that didn't look like it needed fiddling with.
"You never remarried?"
"No," he said.
"Never even close.
Patsy and Maury were all I wanted. Needed. There's not a day when I don't think of them. Not a month when I don't have a dream that they're okay. It was the accident that was the dream, I think. Then I wake up. Tell me something, Jamie. Your mother and your sister, do you ever wonder where they are? If they are?"
"No."
Any scraps of belief that survived the terrible sermon had withered away in high school and college.
I see.
He dropped the regulator and turned on the thing that looked like a Marshall amp, the kind of amp the bands I played with could rarely afford. It hummed, but not like a Marshall. This sound was lower and almost musical.
"Well, let's get on with it, shall we?"
I looked at the chair, but didn't sit on it.
"You were going to give me a little hit first?"
"So I was." He produced the brown bottle, considered it, then handed it to me. "Since we can hope this will be your last, why don't you do the honors?" He didn't have to ask twice. I took 2 heaping snorts and would have doubled down if he hadn't snatched the small bottle away. Nevertheless, a window on a tropic beach opened in my head. A mellow breeze wafted in, and I suddenly no longer cared about what might become of my brainwaves. I sat down in the chair. He opened one of several wall cabinets and brought out a pair of battered, taped-up headphones with crisscrosses of metal mesh over the ear pads. He plugged them into the amp-like device and held them out to me. "If I hear Inagata De Vida, I'm taillights," I said. He smiled and said nothing. I put the headphones on. The mesh was cool against my ears. "Have you tried this on anyone?" I asked. "Will it hurt?" "It won't hurt," he said, not answering the first question at all. As if to contradict this, he gave me a mouthguard of the type basketball players sometimes wear, then smiled at my expression. "Just a precaution. Pop it on in." I popped it on in. From his pocket, he took a white plastic box no bigger than a doorbell. "I think you'll..." But then he pressed a button on the little box, and I lost the rest. There was no blackout, no sense of time passing, no discontinuity at all. Just a click, very loud, as if Jacobs had snapped his fingers beside my ears, although he was standing at least 5 feet away. Yet all at once he was bending over me instead of standing beside the thing that wasn't a Marshall amp. The little white control box was nowhere to be seen, and my brain had gone wrong. It was stuck. "Something," I said. Something happened. "Stop that. You're all right." But he didn't sound sure. He sounded scared. The headphones were gone. I tried to get up and shot one hand into the air instead, like a second grader who knows the right answer and is dying to give it. Something happened. He slapped me, and hard. I jerked backward and would have fallen over if the chair hadn't been placed almost directly against the metal side of his workshop. I lowered my hand, stopped repeating, and just looked at him. "What's your name?" "I'll say it's Something Happened," I thought. "First name Something, last name Happened." But I didn't. "Jamie Morton. Middle name. Edward. My name. Charles Jacobs. Charles Daniel Jacobs." He produced a little bottle of heroin and gave it to me. I looked at it, then handed it back. "I'm good for now. You just gave me some." "Did I?" He showed me his wristwatch. We had arrived at mid-morning. It was now 2:15 in the afternoon. "That's impossible." He looked interested. "Why's that?" "Because no time passed, except, I guess it did, didn't it?" "Yes. We spoke at great length." "What did we talk about?" "Your father, your brothers, your mother's passing, and Claire's." "What did I say about Claire?" "That she married an abusive man and kept quiet about it for 3 years because she was ashamed. She finally opened up to your brother Andy, and..." "His name was Paul Overton," I said. "He taught English at a fancy prep school in New Hampshire. Andy drove down there and waited in the parking lot, and when Overton showed up, Andy beat the living shit out of him. We all loved Claire. Everybody did. I suppose even Paul Overton did in his way. But she and Andy were the oldest, and they were especially close. Is that what I told you?" "Almost word for word. Andy said, 'If you touch her again, I'll kill you.'" "Tell me what else I said." "That Claire moved out, got a protection order, and sued for divorce. She moved to North Conway and got another teaching job. 6 months after the divorce became final, Overton drove up there and shot her dead in her classroom while she was correcting papers after school. Then he killed himself." "Yes, Claire dead. Her funeral had been the last time what remained of my big, brawling, usually happy family was together. A sunny day in October. When it was over, I drove to Florida just because I'd never been there. A month later, I was playing with Patsy Cline's lipstick in Jacksonville. Gas prices were high. The climate was usually warm. And I traded my car for a Kawasaki. Not a good decision, as it turned out. In one corner of the room was a small fridge. He opened it and brought me a bottle of apple juice. I drank it down in 5 long gulps. "See if you can stand up." I rose from the chair and staggered. Jacobs caught me by the elbow and steadied me. "Good so far. Now walk across the room." I did, at first weaving like a drunk, but when I came back, I was okay. Steady Eddie. "Good," he said. "Not a sign of a limp. Let's go back to the fairgrounds. You need to rest." "Something did happen," I said. "What?" "A minor restructuring of your brain waves, I believe."
"You believe?"
"Yes.
But you don't know."
He considered this for what seemed like a long time, although it might only have been seconds. It was a week before anything like a real sense of time returned to me. At last, he said, "I found certain important books very difficult to obtain, and I have a long way to go in my studies as a result. Sometimes that means taking small risks, acceptable ones only. You're fine, aren't you?" I thought it was too early to tell, but didn't say so. After all, the thing was done. "Come on, Jamie. I've got a long night's work ahead of me, and I need rest myself." When we got to his bounder, I tried to reach for the door, and once more stuck my hand straight up in the air instead. The elbow locked. It was as if the joint had turned to iron. For one terrifying moment, I thought it would never come down, that I was just going to spend the rest of my life with one hand raised in that "teacher, teacher, call on me" gesture. Then it let go. I lowered my arm, opened the door, and got in. "That will pass," he said. "How can you know, if you don't really know exactly what you did?" "Because I've seen it before." When he was parked in his usual spot at the fairgrounds, he showed me the little bottle of heroin again. "You can have this if you want it." But I didn't. I felt like a man looking at a banana split minutes after polishing off a 9-course Thanksgiving dinner. You know that sugar-loaded treat is good, and you know that under certain circumstances you would gobble it greedily, but not after a heavy meal. After a heavy meal, a banana split is not an object of desire, but just an object. Later, maybe, I said. But later hasn't come yet. Now, as a going-on elderly man with a touch of arthritis writes of those old days, I know it never will. He cured me, but it was a dangerous cure, and he knew it. When one speaks of acceptable risks, the question is always, acceptable to whom? Charlie Jacobs was a good Samaritan. He was also a half-mad scientist, and that day in the abandoned auto body shop, I was his latest guinea pig. He could have killed me, and sometimes, many times actually, I wish he had. I slept the remainder of the afternoon. When I woke up, I felt like an earlier version of Jamie Morton, clear-headed and full of pep. I swung my legs over the side of his bed and watched him put on his show clothes. "Tell me something," I said. "If it's about our little adventure in West Tulsa, I'd rather not discuss it. Why don't we just wait and see if you remain as you are now, or if you relapse into craving? Damn this tie. I can never get it right, and Briscoe is utterly useless." Briscoe was his assistant, the fellow who mugged and distracted the audience when it needed distracting. "Hold still," I said. "You're making a mess of that. Let me." I stood behind him, reached over his shoulders, and tied the tie. With the shakes gone from my hands, it was easy. Like my walk once the brain shot had worn off, they were steady eddy.
Where did you learn that?
After my accident, when I could stand up and play for a couple hours without falling down, I worked with a group called the Undertakers. It hadn't been much of a group. Any band where I was the best player wasn't. We wore frock coats, stovepipe hats, and string ties. The drummer and the bass player got into a fight over a girl and the group broke up, but I came out of it with a new skill.
Well, thank you.
What did you want to ask me?
About the Portraits and Lightning gig. You only take pictures of women. It seems to me that you're losing 50% of your business that way.
He grinned his boyish grin, the one he'd wore when he was leading the games in the parsonage basement. When I invented the portrait camera, which is actually a combined generator and projector, as I'm sure you know, I did attempt to do both men and women. This was at a little seaside amusement park in North Carolina called Joyland. Out of business now, but it was a lovely place, Jamie. I enjoyed it greatly. During my time in the Midway, which was called Joyland Avenue, there was a rogues gallery next to Mysterio's Mirror Mansion. It featured life-size cardboard figures with cutouts where the faces belonged. There was a pirate, a gangster with an automatic, a tough Jane with a Tommy gun, the Joker and Catwoman from the Batman comics. People would put their faces in, and the park's traveling photographers, Hollywood girls, they were called, would snap their pictures.
That gave you the idea.
Yes. At the time, I was styling myself Mr. Electrico, an homage to Ray Bradbury, but I doubt if any of the rubes knew it. And although I had invented a crude version of my current projector, it had never crossed my mind to feature it in the show. Mostly, I used the Tesla coil and a spark generator called Jacob's Ladder. I demonstrated a small Jacob's Ladder to you kids when I was your minister, Jamie. I used chemicals to make the rising sparks change color. Do you remember?
I did.
The Rogues Gallery made me aware of the possibilities inherent in my projector, and I created Portraits and Lightning. Just another gaffe, you'd say. But it also helped me to advance my studies, and still does. During my stint at Joyland, I used a backdrop featuring a man in expensive black tie as well as the beautiful girl in the ball gown. Some men took me up on it, but surprisingly few. I believe their shit-kicker friends laughed at them when they saw them dressed to the nines like that. Women never laugh, because women love dressing to the nines, to the tens, if possible. And when they see the demonstration, they line up. How long have you been gigging? He calculated, one eye squinted shut. Then he opened them both wide in an expression of surprise. It's almost 15 years now. I shook my head, smiling. You went from preaching to huckstering. As soon as it was out of my mouth, I realized it was a mean thing to say. But the idea of my old minister turning tip still boggled my mind. He wasn't offended, though. He just gave his perfectly knotted tie a final admiring look in the mirror and tipped me a wink. No difference, he said. They're both just a matter of convincing the rubes. Now please excuse me while I go and sell some lightning. He left the heroin on the little table in the middle of the bounder. I glanced at it from time to time, even picked it up once, but I had no urge to use any. To tell you the truth, I couldn't understand why I'd trashed so much of my life over it in the first place. All that crazy need seemed like a dream to me. I wondered if everyone felt that way when their compulsions passed. I didn't know. I still don't. Prisco lit out for the territories, as Gazoonies so often do, and when I asked Jacobs if I could have the job, he agreed at once. There really wasn't much to it, but it spared him the task of finding some local yokel to tote the camera on and off stage, hand him his top hat, and pretend to get electrocuted. He even suggested that I play some chords on my Gibson during the demonstrations. Something suspenseful, he instructed. Something that will put it in the rubes' heads that the girl might actually get fried. This was easy enough. switching between A minor and E, the foundation chords of House of the Rising Sun and the Spring Hill mining disaster, if you're interested, always suggested impending doom. I enjoyed it, although I thought that a big slow drumbeat would have added something. Don't get too wedded to the job, Charles Jacobs advised me. I intend to move on. When the fair closes down, attendance at Bell's goes into the toilet. Move on where? I'm not sure, but I've gotten used to traveling alone, he clapped me on the shoulder. Just so you know. I already did. After the deaths of his wife and child, Charlie Jacobs was strictly a solo act. The visits he made to his workshop grew shorter and shorter. He began bringing some equipment back and stowing it in the small trailer he'd towed behind the bounder when he resumed his rambling. The amplifiers that weren't amplifiers didn't come. Neither did two of the four long metal boxes. I got the idea he meant to start fresh, wherever he ended up, as if he'd gone as far down one road as he could and meant to try another. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my own life, now drug-free and limp-free, that too. But traveling on with the king of high voltage wasn't it. I was grateful to him, but since I could no longer really recall the horrors of heroin addiction, any more, I suppose, than a woman who's had a baby can recall the pain of childbirth, not as grateful as you might think. Also, he scared me. So did his secret electricity. He talked about it in extravagant terms, secret of the universe, path to ultimate knowledge. But he had no more idea of what it really was than a toddler has of a gun he finds in Daddy's closet. And speaking of closets, I snooped, okay? And what I found was a photograph album filled with pictures of Patsy, Maury, and the three of them together. The pages were well thumbed, and the binding was loose. It didn't take Sam Spade to know he looked at those pictures a lot, but I never saw him do it. The album was a secret, like his electricity. In the early morning hours of October 3rd, shortly before the Tulsa State Fair shut up shop for another year, I suffered another after effect of the brain blast Jacobs had given me. Jacobs was paying me for my services, quite a bit more than the services actually merited, and I had rented a room by the week about 4 blocks from the fairgrounds. It was clear he wanted to be alone, no matter how much he liked me, if he did like me, and I felt it was high time he got his own bed back. I turned in at midnight, about an hour after we wrapped the last show of the evening, and went to sleep at once. I almost always did. With a dope out of my system, I slept well. Only that morning I woke up 2 hours later, in the weedy backyard of the rooming house. An icy rind of moon hung overhead. Beneath it stood Jamie Morton, naked save for one sock and with a piece of rubber tubing wrapped around his biceps. I have no idea where I got it, but above it the blood vessels, any one of them perfect for shooting up, bulged. Below it, my forearm was white and cold and fast asleep. Something happened, I said. I had a fork in one hand. God knows where that came from, too. And I was poking my swollen upper arm with it over and over again. Blood was beating up from at least a dozen pricks. Something happened. Something happened. Oh, mother, something happened. Something. I told myself to stop, but at first I couldn't. I wasn't out of control, exactly, but I was out of my control. I thought of Electric Jesus trundling across Peaceable Lake on a hidden rail. I was like that. Something. Stab. Something happened. Stab, stab. Something. I stuck out my tongue and bit it. The click came again, not beside my ears, but buried deep inside my head. The compulsion to speak and stab was gone. Just like that. The fork tumbled from my hand. I unwrapped the makeshift tourniquet, and my forearm began to prickle as the blood rushed back into it. I looked up at the moon, shivering and wondering who or what had been controlling me, because I had been controlled. When I got back to my room, grateful not to be seen with my wing-wang dangling in the breeze. I saw I had stepped on some broken glass and cut my foot quite badly. It should have awakened me, but hadn't. Why? Because I hadn't been asleep. I was sure of it. Something had moved me out of myself and taken over, driving my body like a car. I washed my foot and got back into bed. I never told Jacobs about that experience. What good would it have done? He would have suggested that a gashed foot, suffered on a little midnight stroll, was a small price to pay for a miracle cure from heroin addiction, and he would have been right. Still, something happened. Closing day at the Tulsa State Fair that year was October 10th. I arrived at Jacob's Bounder around 5:30 that afternoon, and plenty of time to tune my guitar and tie his tie, a thing that had become a tradition. While I was doing it, there was a knock at the door. Charlie went to answer it, frowning. He had 6 shows to do that night, including the final one at midnight, and he didn't like being interrupted beforehand. He opened the door, saying, "If it's not important, I wish you'd come back late." And then a farmer in bib overalls and a case cap, a pissed-off Okie, if ever an Okie there was, punched him in the mouth. Jacobs went staggering back, got tangled in his own feet, and went down, narrowly avoiding giving his head a good whap on the dinette table, which might have knocked him unconscious. Our visitor barged in, bent down, seized Jacobs by the lapels. He was about Jacobs' age, but a lot bigger, and he was in a rage. This could be trouble, I thought. Of course it was already, but I was thinking of the kind that ends with an extended stay in the hospital.
"You're the reason she got took in by the police," he shouted. "God damn you, she'll have a record to follow her around for the rest of her life, like a tin can tied to a puppy dog's tail."
I didn't think. I just seized an empty pot from the sink and bonked him briskly on the side of the head. It wasn't a hard blow, but the Okie let go of Jacobs and looked at me in astonishment. Tears began leaking down the grooves on either side of his considerable beak. Charlie scooted away, propped on his hands and propelling himself with his feet. Blood was pouring from his lower lip, which was split in 2 places. "Why don't you pick on someone your own size?" I asked. Hardly reasoned discourse, I know, but when we find ourselves in that sort of confrontation, how the schoolyard comes back.
"She gotta go to court,"
he shouted at me in that out-of-tune banjo Okie accent.
"And it's that sucker's fault, that sucker right here, scuttling like a dead burn crab."
He said dead burn. He really did. I put the pot on the stove and showed him my empty hands. I spoke in my most soothing voice. "I don't know who you're talking about, and I'm sure," I almost said Charles, "I'm sure Dan doesn't either."
"My daughter. My daughter Kathy. Kathy Morse. He told her the picture was free because she got up on stage, but it wasn't free. That picture has costed her plenty. Ruined a dad burn life is what that picture did."
I put a cautious arm around his shoulders. I thought he might clobber me, but now that his initial fury had been vented, he only looked sad and bewildered. "Come on outside," I said. "We'll find a bench in the shade, and you can tell me all about it."
"Who are you?"
I was going to say Mr. Jacobs' assistant, but that sounded like pretty weak tea. My years as a musician came to my rescue. His agent.
"Yeah? Can you give me compensation? Because I want it. The lawyer's fees alone about to half kill me."
He pointed a finger at Jacobs.
"On account of you. Your daggum fault."
I have no idea. Charlie wiped a palm full of blood off his chin. "I have no idea what you're talking about, Mr. Morse, I assure you." I had gotten Morse as far as the door, and I didn't want to lose the ground I had gained. "Let's discuss this out in the fresh air." He let me lead him out. There was a refreshment stand at the edge of the employees' parking lot, with rusty tables shaded by tattered canvas umbrellas. I bought him a large Coke and handed it to him. He slopped the first inch out on the table then drank half the paper cup in big swallows. He set it down and pressed the heel of his palm to his forehead.
I never learned not to take a cold drink like that, he said. Puts a nail in your head, don't it?
Yes, I said, and thought of standing naked in scant moonlight, poking the tines of a fork into my blood-engorged upper arm. Something happened to me, and it seemed to Kathy Morse as well. Tell me what the problem seems to be.
That picture he gave her, that's a goddamn problem. She walked around with it damn near everywhere. Her friends commenced on to making fun of her, but she didn't care. She told people, that's how I really look. I tried to shake the notion out of her one night, and Mother told me to stop. Said it would pass on its own. And it seemed to. She left the picture in her room, I don't know, 2 days or three. Went on down to the hairdressing school without it. We thought it was over.
It wasn't. On October 7th, 3 days previous, she had walked into J. David Jewelry in Broken Arrow, a town southeast of Tulsa. She was carrying a shopping bag. Both salesmen recognized her, because she'd been in several times since her star turn at Jacobs' midway pitch. One of them asked if he could help her. Kathy blew past him without a word and went to the display case, where the most expensive gewgaws were kept. From her shopping bag she produced a hammer, which she used to shatter the glass top of the case. Ignoring the bray of the alarm and two cuts serious enough to warrant stitches,
"And them will leave scars,"
her father mourned. She reached in and took out a pair of diamond earrings.
"These are mine," she said. "They go with my dress."
Morris had no more than finished his story when two wide boys with security printed on their black T-shirts showed up.
"Is there a problem here?" one of them asked.
"No," I said, and there wasn't. Telling the story had finished venting his rage, which was good. It had also shriveled him somehow, and that wasn't so good. Mr. Morris was just leaving. He got up, clutching the remains of his Coke. Charlie Jacobs' blood was drying on his knuckles. He looked at it, as if he didn't know where it had come from.
"Sicking the cops on him wouldn't do no good, would it?" he asked. "All he did was take a picture, they'd say. Hell, it was even free."
"Come on, sir," one of the security guys said. "If you'd like to visit the fair, I'd be happy to stamp your hand."
"No, sir," he said. "My family's had enough of this fair. I'm going home."
He started off, then turned back.
"Has he done it before, mister? Has he knocked other ones for a loop the way he knocked my Kathy?"
Something happened, I thought. Something, something, something. "No," I said, "not at all."
"Like you'd say, even if he did. You being his agent and all."
Then he went away, head lowered, not looking back. In the Bounder, Jacobs had changed his blood-spotted shirt and had a dish towel filled with ice on his fattening lower lip. He listened while I told him what Morris had told me, then said, "Tie my tie for me again, will you? We're already late."
"Whoa," I said, "whoa, whoa, whoa. You need to fix her up,
the way you fixed me up, with the headphones." He gave me a look that was perilously close to contempt. "Do you think Daddy Dearest would let me within a mile of her? Besides, what's wrong with her, her compulsion, will wear off on its own. She'll be fine, and any lawyer worth his salt will be able to convince the judge that she wasn't herself. She'll get off with a slap on the wrist. None of this is exactly new to you, is it?" He shrugged, still looking in my direction, but no longer quite meeting my eyes. "There have been after effects from time to time, yes. Although nothing quite so spectacular as Miss Morse's attempted smash and grab. You're self-teaching, aren't you? All your customers are actually guinea pigs. They just don't know it. I was a guinea pig. Are you better now or not?
Yes, except for the occasional early morning stabathon, that was.
Then please tie my tie.
I almost didn't. I was angry with him. On top of everything else, he'd snuck out the back way and yelled for security. But I owed him. He had saved my life, which was good. I was now living a straight life, and that was even better. So I tied his tie. We did the show. In fact, we did 6 of them. The crowd hawed when the close of the fair fireworks went off, but never so loud as they did when Dan, the lightning portraits man, worked his magic. And as each girl stared dreamily up at herself on the backdrop while I switched between A minor and E, I wondered which among them would discover that she had lost a little piece of her mind. An envelope sticking under my door. Deja vu all over again, Yogi would have said. Only this time I hadn't peed in my bed. My surgically mended leg didn't ache. I wasn't coming down with the flu. And I wasn't jitter-jiving with the need to score. I bent, picked it up, and tore it open. My fifth business wasn't one for gooey goodbyes, I'll give him that. The envelope contained an Amtrak ticket envelope with a sheet of notepaper paperclipped to it. Written there were a name and an address in the town of Nederland, Colorado. Below, Jacobs had scrawled 3 sentences. This man will give you a job if you want it. He owes me. Thanks for tying my tie. C.D.J. I opened the Amtrak envelope and found a 1-way ticket on the Mountain Express from Tulsa to Denver. I looked at it for a long time, thinking that maybe I could turn it in and get a cash refund, or use it and make the Musicians Exchange in Denver my first stop. Only it would take a while to get that groove thing going again. My fingers had gone soft and my chops were rusty. There was also the dope thing to consider. When you're on the road, dope is everywhere. The magic wore off the portraits and lightning after 2 years or so, Jacobs had said. How did I know it wouldn't be the same with cures for addiction? How could I know, when he didn't know himself? That afternoon, I took a cab to the auto body shop he'd rented in West Tulsa. It was abandoned and bare to the walls. There wasn't so much as a single snip of wire on the grease-darkened floor. Something happened to me here, I thought. The question was whether or not I'd put on those modified headphones again, given the chance to do it over. I decided I would, and in some fashion I didn't quite understand. That helped me make up my mind about the ticket. I used it, and when I got to Denver, I took the bus to Nederland, high up on the western slopes of the Rockies. There I met Hugh Yates and began my life for the third time.